14-year-old Jason Lehman is a philosopher of the highest order. A poem that he wrote appeared in the syndicated column, Dear Abby. And let me read it to you. Jason says, "It was spring, but it was summer I wanted. The warm days and the great outdoors. It was summer, but it was fall I wanted. The colorful leaves and the cool, dry air. It was fall, but it was winter I wanted. The beautiful snow and the joy of the holiday season. It was a child, but it was adulthood I wanted. The freedom and the respect. I was 20, but it was 30 I wanted. To be mature and sophisticated. I was middle-aged, but it was 20 I wanted. The youth and the free spirit. I was retired, and it was middle age I wanted. The presence of mind without limitations. My life was over, but I never got what I wanted." This is what King Solomon, or the Ecclesiastes, or the preacher, has been trying to tell us. He had searched for meaning and purpose in life. He had looked down every avenue, and yet he had never gotten what he wanted. He had come to the conclusion that life under the sun, life apart from God, is vanity. It's nothingness. It's emptiness. It's like chasing after soap bubbles. He had discovered that life finds meaning only as it relates to God. This is what you've discovered if you've really probed into life and really examined the various aspects of life. We live for a few years and then we die. And so what? What have we left behind? What have we really accomplished? Nothing unless there is an eternity, unless there is a God who rewards and a God who blesses. Life finds meaning only as it relates to God. Solomon had turned down many avenues in his search. Old Testament scholar Herbert Leopold once said of Solomon's quest, "No era of Israel's history was richer in possibilities for various pleasures, and no person in a better position to make the most of them than Solomon." Solomon was a man who had means to experience and to experiment with every experience imaginable. He had great wealth. He had great access to pleasures and to entertainment. If life and if meaning could be found apart from God in life, Solomon could have found it. The experiences were available to him. He searched in science. He searched in wisdom and philosophy. We've talked about his search in pleasure and entertainment. He searched through achievement. He looked to living for the here and now. He looked to power and popularity. He looked down all these various avenues, and yet he found that they were dead ends. They all led to the same conclusion. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity. Chasing after soap bubbles. It's interesting, William Cowper once described life as the toil of dropping buckets into empty wells and growing old in drawing up nothing. How vivid. This was Solomon's conclusion. He had it all, and yet nothing mattered. Tonight, Solomon's search turns down a few more avenues. He looks to religion. He looks to wealth. He looks to wisdom and to morality. And he discovers, as he has so far, that it's all vanity without God. Chapter 5 we read, "Walk prudently when you go to the house of God." Now this expression, "walk prudently," literally means to watch your step or to tread lightly. Don't forget that Solomon was the one who built the temple. He spent 7 years laboring on the project. He invested enormous wealth and materials in the construction of the temple. He was its builder. And yet, even though he built the temple, he experienced no special privileges, no special advantages when he went into the temple. For he came to God as every other man came to God. It's important to realize that God has no prima donnas. That everybody comes to God on an equal basis. And Solomon is the king, but he knows that when he goes to the temple, he must walk prudently. He must watch how he acts in the presence of God, what he says and what he does. Coming to God is serious business. Solomon was king, but he also knew who the King of Kings really was. And so he says, walk prudently when you come to the temple, when you enter into the house of the Lord. Be careful. Approaching God is serious business. This is still true. You know, there are many people who treat religion as a hobby. It's a plaything. They toy around with the things of God. And they don't realize the seriousness of entering into the presence of a holy God. He says to watch your step, to tread lightly when you go to the house of God and draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they do evil. Do not be rash with your mouth. And let not your heart utter anything hastily before God. For God is in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. I believe there is nothing as ugly and as nauseous to God as spiritual pride. As someone who stands and up in church and begins to brag and boast about their accomplishments, what they have done for God, how they have trusted God. Oh, how they have served the Lord. Nothing is more nauseous and more despicable in His sight than someone becoming spiritually proud and becoming spiritually arrogant, bragging about his spiritual prowess or accomplishments. You remember when Jesus sent the disciples out two by two? They came back rejoicing and talking about, Lord, you know, how the demons were even subject to us in your name. And yet, remember what Jesus told them. He said, hey, guys, I saw Satan fall from heaven. Big deal. These demons are cast. Big deal. I saw the big guy, Satan, thrown down out of heaven. If you want to rejoice, rejoice in this. Not, you know, what you're doing for me, but rejoice that your names have been written in the book of life. When we come before God, our focus should be not on what we're doing for God, but on what God has done for us. This is the true source of celebration. This is the true joy. God has done so much for us. Whatever we do for Him is just a response. It's just a result of all that He has done for us. When we're in the presence of God, we need to be careful what we say, what we pray, and what we promise. Our motive should never be to impress men, but to please God. If religion is your hobby, if you've learned the right lingo, if you've learned how to pray in public, and you like to pray in public because, boy, you can impress people when you pray. You can pray smooth. You can pray fluently. You know how to say just the right thing at the right time. If that's your attitude, God is not pleased. You see, don't be rash with your mouth. Don't, you know, come in speaking and babbling and saying all these things. John Bunyan in Pilgrim's Progress wrote, in prayer, it is better to have a heart without words than words without a heart. When we come to God, we need to be honest. We need to be deliberate and sincere. We need to make sure that what comes out of our mouth is in truth also coming out of our heart. And we're not just saying things for the sake of saying them. Don't sing a song unless you mean it. Don't come to church and sing, oh, I surrender all to Jesus, I surrender all. Don't sing that unless you mean it. Don't get into the habit of just coming and singing what they're leading and not meaning it when you sing it. Make sure that what comes out of your mouth is also coming out of your heart, or else don't say it. Be careful that you be not rash with your mouth and that you let not your heart utter anything hastily before God. You remember Ananias and Sapphira lied to the Holy Spirit. You remember how God judged them. Thank God He doesn't judge us the same way. I surrender all. Boop, boop. Fall on the ground dead. You know, we're going to worship, you know. We have people dropping over dead in the pews, you know, left and right. You know, it's praise the Lord that He doesn't judge us today as severely as He did in that day. We'd all be in trouble. But be careful what you say. Religion is not a hobby. Approaching God is serious business. And we need to be sincere as we come to Him. He says, for a dream comes through much activity. In other words, it's easy to have good intentions. It's easy to have all these dreams and all these visions without really sitting down and counting the cost. It's easy to make promises to God without thinking through what those promises are going to involve and being certain that I'm going to be able to keep those promises. So many times I have people come to me and they are so excited. They tell me their dreams and the visions that God has given them and the great ambitions that God has laid on their heart, saying, God is calling me to do this, God is calling me to do that. And yet we don't see them follow through on those callings. See, a Christian and a tennis player have this in common. In order to have a good serve, you have to have a good follow-through. Don't get caught up in the swirl of activity, in the electrifying atmosphere of emotion, and make promises to God that you're unable to keep. Be careful. Think through it. Count the cost before you make a promise to God or to someone else. I'm so guilty of promising people on Sunday morning, yeah, I'm going to pray for you, and then I don't do it. It's terrible. It's terrible. We need to be careful what we say. How many times have you heard people who were in a terrible bind? And they said, oh Lord, if you'll just deliver me from this bind. Lord, I'll follow you. I'll do this. I'll do that. And then as soon as they get out, they forget all about their promise. He said, for a dream comes through much activity. It's easy to make a promise. It's easy to dream dreams and share visions. He says, but a fool's voice is known by his many words. You know, you do it. You get used to hearing people make all these promises and never follow through, and they get a reputation, don't they? You know, a fool is known by all these great things that he's going to do, and yet he never does them. When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for He has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. It is better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Now, certain vows were allowed by God. People took them in order to demonstrate a special devotion or a special calling that they had undertaken in a special way of showing their devotion to God. There were all sorts of different types of vows that the Jews could take. They were all optional. None of them were required. But they could take a certain vow to express a specific devotion to God. Example, the vow of the Nazarite. You remember the vow of the Nazarite? The person who was taking the vow pledged himself to not take any wine, not to shave his head, and not to touch anything that was dead. You remember Samson was a Nazarite. Samuel, John the Baptist were all Nazarites. The vow could be taken for life, or it could be taken for a temporary duration of time. Remember, Paul took one of these temporary vows when he went into the temple to appease the Jews in Acts chapter 21. Now, some of you have taken a vow. You've taken a marriage vow. It wasn't something that God required you to do. You know, I officiated most of your weddings, and I don't remember any shotgun weddings. I don't remember any of you being ushered down the aisle with the father-in-law with the gun stuck in your back. If I remember correctly, most of you, when you got married, you know, we had two willing parties here. Two people that wanted to be here and wanted to be a part. Wanted to take this vow to God. Nowhere does God make you take a vow. Just like none of you were made to come to the altar. You came because you wanted to, because you were in love with someone and you wanted to express this commitment with the deepest, strongest possible terms that you could place upon it to show the one you love just how much you love them. And yet, how many of us have lived up to those vows? Listen, what he's telling us here is if we take a vow, we are obligated to keep it. If you didn't want to keep it, you shouldn't have took it in the first place. It had been better for you not to take the vow than to have taken it and not keep it. Fellas, when you said you were going to love your wife as Christ loves the church, you said in richer or poorer, in sickness and in health. When the hormones are up and when they're not. When she's ornery and when she's not, until death do you part. You made that vow. And you not only made that vow to her, you made that vow to God. And God took it as such. Same thing, ladies. You made a vow to your husband in sickness and health. It wasn't a conditional thing. You made a lifelong commitment to that man. God expects you to keep it. Sylvester Stallone once said, in reference to his portrayal of Rocky in the movies, he said, "Boxing is a great exercise as long as you can yell cut whenever you want to." I would imagine it is. A lot of fun as long as you can yell cut just before the guy throws the right hook at you. But a lot of people have taken marriage the same way. When the going gets rough, when they find themselves pinned against the ropes, they yell cut. They want to split. They want to get out of the marriage. Listen, if you've taken a vow before God and to your mate, God expects you to keep it. Better to not have taken the vow than to take it and not keep it. He says, "Do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands?" In other words, don't, you know, pipe up and say, "Well, but I was so young back then. You know, I didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't know her. I made a mistake." None of that matters to God. He doesn't want to hear your excuses. God doesn't accept those excuses. You took a vow, for rich or for poor, in sickness and in health, until death do you part. God expects you to keep it. He says, "For in the multitude of dreams and many words, there is also vanity, but fear God." He says, "If you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, do not marvel at the matter. For high official watches over high official, and higher officials are over them. Moreover, the profit of the land is for all. The king himself is served from the field." The Living Bible has a very interesting paraphrase of verse 8. It goes, "If you see some poor man being oppressed by the rich with miscarriage of justice, don't be surprised. For every official is under orders from higher up, and the higher officials look up to their superiors, and so the matter is lost in red tape and bureaucracy." In other words, if an issue doesn't pad the politician's pockets, or if it doesn't buy him more votes, there's a good chance that somehow it'll just get lost in red tape and bureaucracy. You know, men are corrupt, and as long as men govern, you can expect corrupt government. Solomon says, "Don't be surprised when you see corruption in government." According to verse 9, the only thing that holds them in check is that they depend upon the taxpayer you know, to stay in power and to pay their taxes so that they can, you know, you live the lifestyle that they've become accustomed to and so forth. And so, you know, the only check in the whole system is they'll go just as far as they can go as long as it doesn't make the taxpayer angry, and then they'll back off. He says even the king eats from the field. So it's the working man, it's the taxpayer, the only person that keeps them in check. And as long as you tolerate it, they'll do it. But when you rise up and get angry at them, then all of a sudden they'll start towing the line. That's the language that they speak. You remember, this is what happened to Rehoboam, Solomon's son. He forgot his father's advice. And he taxed the people and taxed the people. And he laid heavy taxes on them, so much so that they rebelled against him. And the northern 10 tribes split from the southern 2 tribes and formed their own kingdom. And for several hundred years, the nation existed as a divided kingdom, the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. So the people will only take so much. And then we've had it, you know, that's it. And they'll revolt. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. Now he looks down the road of wealth to try to find meaning and purpose. And Solomon, if anybody could ever talk about having a stash of wealth, it was Solomon. He had bank accounts, unbelievable. His yearly allowance of gold, according to 1 Kings, consisted of 666 talents of gold. Now, a talent was approximately 100 pounds, give or take a few pounds. 666 talents of gold equaled about 66,600 pounds of gold. According to current gold prices, that amounted to about $400 million a year, Solomon's annual salary. Now, if there was ever a man who could find meaning and purpose in wealth, it would have been Solomon, because he had it. And yet Solomon here says that, hey, the guy who loves silver will never be satisfied with silver. The thing about wealth, the thing about money, is the more you get of it, the more you want it. Money can never satisfy. Solomon was unable to find purpose in his purse. He says, when goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. In other words, a man who labors, who barely carves out a living, he works hard and he sleeps well. But the rich man tosses and turns all night because he's worried about his riches. He's worried about what he's going to do with his wealth, how he can protect it, how he's going to hold on to it, how he's going to invest it, how he's going to maintain that specific standard of living. There's a lot of pressure on the rich man that's not on the poor man. You know, what's he going to do with his wealth? How's he going to protect it? Everybody wants it. Everybody's trying to break in and steal it. How can he protect it? And so he lives his life in anxieties. It's interesting, but riches multiply anxieties. When you don't have anything, you don't have to worry about it. But when you got a little something, you got to try to protect it. I heard a man who said, when your outgo exceeds your income, your upkeep will be your downfall. Let me say that there is nothing wrong with riches. There's nothing wrong with having money. If you've got it, God bless you. I want to be your friend. No, I'm just kidding. There's nothing wrong with riches. What's wrong is when we start treating it like a god. When you love it, you treat it like a god. When you make sacrifices for it, you're treating it like a god. When you assume that it can do anything, and you put your security and trust in it, you're treating it like a god. As one man said, money may not be the number one thing in my life, but it's way ahead of number two. That's a dangerous attitude. Remember, it's not money that's the root of all evil. It's the love of money, Paul says, is the root of all evil. I like what John Wesley said about money. I think it's a good balance for the Christian. He said, make all you can, save all you can, give all you can. I like that. Make all you can, save all you can, give all you can. He says, there is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun. Riches kept for their owner to his hurt. But those riches perish through misfortune when he begets a son. There is nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return, to go as he came. And he shall take nothing from his labor which he may carry away in his hand. And this also is a severe evil, that just exactly as he came, so shall he go. And what profit has he who has labored for the wind? All his days he also eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. In other words, he's saying, I've never seen a hearse pulling a U-Haul. You can't take it with you. He's saying it's a sad thing to see a man who's invested all his life in making money, and yet when he dies, he has to leave it for someone else to enjoy. It's a vain thing. It's emptiness. It's meaningless. There's a Jewish proverb that goes, shrouds have no pockets. You can't take it with you. How many people do we see grabbing and hoarding, putting their trust, putting their security in money? You remember the parable Jesus told about the rich man who said, eat, drink, and be merry, who built new barns to put all of his wealth in, and yet that very night he was struck dead. You can store it up, but you can't take it with you. I have good news for you, though. There is one way in which you can send it ahead, and that's by investing it in the work of God, by giving it to the service of God. You can begin to send those blessings on ahead so that when you get to heaven, you'll find that the giving that you've done on earth has provided for you treasure in heaven. Never forget what Jesus said. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. He says, here's what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. The Living Bible also paraphrases verse 19, and I think it gives you the essence of what he's saying. It says, to enjoy your work and to accept your lot in life, this indeed is a gift from God. What he's telling us here is that in order to be successful in life, in order to live a happy life, we need to learn to enjoy our life without expecting too much out of it. To enjoy the blessings that God gives as simply blessings. Enjoying the giver of those gifts rather than turning the gifts into an idol and worshiping the gifts instead of the giver. We all need to learn to enjoy life, to enjoy the blessings that God gives. But remember, they're just that. They're just blessings. And that God never intended for you to find real meaning and real purpose in things under the sun. They're gifts to you. They're enjoyments here on earth and for this time. But they won't satisfy your heart. Only one thing will satisfy your heart, and that's God. We were made with a God-shaped vacuum inside. And only God can fill it. What he's telling us here is, hey, just accept what God has given you, the blessings God has given you. Enjoy them rather than worrying about what you don't have. Enjoy what you do have. Lighten up on life a little bit. savor, relish the blessings that God has given you. Remember what Paul said to Timothy, but godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. The most we can expect from life under the sun is some simple pleasures, some simple enjoyments, some momentary blessings. But the real meaning, the real fulfillment, comes not from life under the sun, but it comes from the Son, S-O-N, Jesus Christ, and our relationship with Him. Enjoyment without God is idolatry. Enjoyment with God is fulfillment and satisfaction. It's taking the blessings and using them for what they were intended to do. There's a basic principle in life, and it goes like this. No one can truly enjoy the gifts of God apart from the God who gives the gifts. No one can enjoy the gifts of God apart from the God who gives the gifts. Try to take life as it exists in and of itself, and it'll disappoint. It'll dissatisfy. But when you see life as it relates to God, it finds its meaning. It finds its purpose. It becomes fulfilling. Your marriage, your family, in and of itself, you know, what's it worth? What's the deal about it? Man, it's a hassle. You have to come home. You have to put up with these hotbed of personal relationships. I mean, it's just, what's it worth? Nothing in and of itself, but as it relates to God, it's very valuable. It has a very important purpose. Your job, going to work every day, bringing home the paycheck, buying groceries with it, feeding yourself so you can go back to work and do the whole thing over again. What's it worth? Why not just stay in bed? Shrivel up and die. You're going to die anyway. Just cycle it out faster, you know. What's the deal? Well, in and of itself, you're right. It is vain. It is empty. But when you see that God has a purpose for your work, that it's a way that you can express your love in relationship to Him, it becomes meaningful. There's purpose. There's great pleasure you derive from it. You see, all of life, taken in and of itself, it's vain, it's empty, it's chasing after soap bubbles, popping in your hands. What makes life worth living is living it with God. He says, there is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is common among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that he lacks nothing for himself of all he desires, yet God does not give him power to eat of it, but a foreigner consumes it. This is vanity, and it is an evil affliction. It's been said that seldom do you see a rich man with a smile on his face. Riches multiply anxieties and worries. Solomon says it's a tragedy to see a man with so much, and yet he enjoys it so little. It was said that ex-Beatle John Lennon, who achieved incredible success, that he lived out the later years of his life a recluse, afraid of people, a very unhappy man. He had all the fame and popularity in the world, and he didn't have the power to enjoy it. No matter what you possess, if you don't possess the ability to enjoy it, so what? What's it worth? He says, if a man begets 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with goodness, or indeed he has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better than he. For it comes in vanity and departs in darkness, and his name is covered with darkness. Though it has not seen the sun or known anything, this is more rest than that man. Even if he lives 1,000 years twice over, but has not seen goodness, do not all go to one place? You know, a large, long life, a large family, these are features of life that many people strive for. I feel like if they can just have that big family or live a long life, that they can have a happy life. But a long life is not always a happy life. Benjamin Disraeli, the British statesman and prime minister, lived a very long life, experienced much in his life. He lived 77 years, and yet he concluded, youth is a blunder, manhood a struggle, and old age a regret. It's been said, so what if you add years to your life, if you don't add life to your years? You can live 2,000 years, Solomon says. Search and search and search for meaning. But unless you find it, what's it worth? So what if you live a long life? So what if you have a large family? None of these things satisfy without God. C.S. Lewis put it, God cannot give us happiness or peace apart from Himself because it is not there. There is no such thing. He says, all the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the soul is not satisfied. You see, here's where we get to it. It's not what goes into my mouth that satisfies me, but it's what goes into my heart. It's not the physical things that can satisfy me, because my real hungers are not physical hungers. My real hungers, my underlying hungers, are spiritual hungers and cravings. So it takes spiritual substance to satisfy those cravings. And you can't satisfy spiritual cravings with physical substance. It just doesn't work. It doesn't satisfy. It's so sad, and yet we see it so often. A man with a family, a good wife, good friends, a good church, a good job, two cars. I mean, a guy who's really blessed, and yet he can't enjoy it. He's so discontent. He's so unhappy. The reason? He's expecting too much out of life. He expects the things that he has to satisfy his heart, and they never do. There's only one source of satisfaction, and that's God. And everything else finds its meaning as it relates to Him. You see, the ability to be happy comes not from without. It comes from within. It's not an acquisition of my hands. It's an attitude of my heart. What have we been studying on Sunday morning? Blessed or happy is the man who what? Who has these attitudes. Who has a right relationship with God. Happiness is not the result of direct pursuit. It never is. It's always a byproduct. It always hits you by surprise. As you seek righteousness and a right relationship with God, suddenly you become happy and you don't know how it happened. You're just happy. You weren't looking for it, but it just came. Happiness is a byproduct of getting our lives right with God. He says, for what more has the wise man than the fool? What does the poor man have who knows how to walk before the living? In other words, the rich man and the poor man, they both can only sleep in one bed. They both can only sleep in one house. They both can only drive one car at a time. They only eat three meals a day. I mean, when you strip the fluff off, really there's not much difference, is there, between the rich man and the poor man? He says, better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Of course, you've heard the proverb, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. That's what he's saying here. You know, it's better to have your eyes, better to know what you want and to have your eyes fastened on it than to be just wandering and dreaming of things. It's been said it is better to have little and really enjoy it than to dream about much and never attain it. Better to go ahead and enjoy what you have rather than be constantly longing for what you don't have. Many of you could just have a happy life. Man, you could have a happy life. If you just look around at the blessings God's given you right now and just enjoy them. No reason in the world you can't have a happy life. What frustrates you is all the things you don't have and you think you need. And if you got them, there'd be something else you'd need. And if you just lighten up, if you just enjoy what you have now, you could be happy. You got all you need to be happy right now. The main thing is you got God. He says, whatever one is, he has been named already. For it is known that he is man, and he cannot contend with him who is mightier than he. Since there are many things that increase vanity, how is man the better? In other words, a man is a man is a man. You will always be a man. Man always strives for immortality. And yet he never achieves it. Only God is immortal. Only God is incorruptible. You're a man, and that's all you can expect to be as a man. You're going to die. What Solomon is saying is, in the long run, it doesn't really matter whether you're rich or you're poor. He says, for who knows what is good for man in life, all the days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? Who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? What Solomon is saying to us is that a man's life is like a ship cutting through the ocean, plowing up a wake as it goes. And yet a few minutes later, that wake is non-existent. And the sea is clear and calm again. And it was as if that ship had never passed. He's saying, looking at life under the sun, we're all like little ships passing through the ocean. Give us a few minutes after we pass, and it's as if we'd never been. That's how meaningful life is apart from God. He says, a good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. Now, Solomon was one who knew the value of a good reputation. He said in Proverbs 22, a good name is to be chosen rather than great riches, and loving favor rather than silver and gold. I've heard it said that a man has three names. One his father gave him, one others call him, and one he acquires himself. You are building a name for yourself. And a good name is better than precious ointment. I heard of two brothers who were mean, dirty, nasty, terrible people. Two mobsters. And one of the brothers was shot in a holdup. And he came to the preacher who was assigned to do his funeral. And he said, preacher, he said, I would really like for you to stand up tomorrow and tell everyone that my brother was a good man. And the preacher said, I can't do that. If I did that, I'd be lying. And so the man, thinking to himself, well, you know, everybody has his price, said to the preacher, he said, well, you know, preacher, says, if you did say my brother was a good man, there might be a real healthy, hefty donation to the church's building fund. And so he said, well, I'll see what I can do. And the guy handed him the money. Well, the next morning at the funeral, he stood up in front of all the people and he said, this man laying here before us here, he was a dirty, nasty, low-down, terrible human being. But compared to his brother, he was a good man. Solomon knew the value of a good reputation. And yet, from personal experience, Solomon knew how that good reputation could become soiled and could be destroyed. It takes a lifetime to build a good reputation. It takes only one night to see it wiped out. And what Solomon is saying here, the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. He's saying that a reputation is sealed only when a person dies. That up until the time of a person's death, I mean, they still have the potential of blowing it and destroying their good reputation. I'll never forget, I was out playing golf with my dad one day, and a stranger sort of joined us. And the guy asked my dad, you know, what do your two sons do for a living? And he said, well, they're both pastors. And he said, boy, I bet you're really proud of them. And he says, yes. He said, so far. I'll never forget that. So far. And I still got time to blow it. Still got time to ruin it. And what Solomon is saying is that, hey, at a birth, it's a joyous occasion. But it's overshadowed by the uncertainties of what that life is going to hold and what that little child is going to get into. Whereas at a funeral, though it's a sad time, everyone can breathe a sigh of relief because it's finished, it's over. Nothing can be added, nothing will be taken away. That reputation is sealed. He said, it is better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting. For that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. Now, if any of us were given the choice of going to a birthday party or going to a funeral, well, we'd all choose to go to the birthday party, I'm sure. Nobody likes to go to funerals. And yet Solomon is saying, a funeral does you more good than a birthday party. Because a funeral forces you to face squarely the real issue in life, and that's your death. A funeral busts through the myth that so many of us accept, and that's that we're going to live forever. Or at least that's the way we live. That's the way we act. C.S. Lewis's wife once asked a friend of hers, did she ever think of death? She said, oh no, by the time I reach that age, science will have done something about it. I think a lot of us live our lives that way. We think that by the time we get to that point, science is going to do something about it, that we're not going to have to face death. We deny death. We live in a state of denial. We go on about our lives as if we're never going to die. Solomon is saying to go to the funeral. Don't forsake that sorrow in the house of mourning, because it will teach you more than the house of mirth and the house of laughter. To face death squarely, to realize that we are vulnerable, that we're not going to live forever, that each one of us is passing on to judgment, will motivate us to get our lives right with God here and now. He says in verse 3, sorrow is better than laughter, for by a sad countenance the heart is made better. You know, there is much that we can learn from sorrow. I read it recently, but I want to read it again. It's a beautiful little poem, and I think it speaks very profoundly. It goes, I walked a mile with pleasure, and she chatted all the way, but left me none the wiser for all she had to say. I walked a mile with sorrow, and ne'er a word said she, but oh, the things I learned from her when sorrow walked with me. There's much we can learn from sorrow. It's been said God whispers to us in our pleasures. He speaks to us in our conscience. But He shouts at us in our pains and in our sorrows. He says, the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. Remember what Jesus said, blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. He said, it is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. For like the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity. The word laughter here means a scoffing kind of a laughter, a haughty, audacious kind of a laughter. You know, this is the laughter of a fool. It's loud, it's boisterous, like a popping fire, and yet how quickly it burns out, goes to ashes. He says, surely oppression destroys a wise man's reason, and a bribe debases the heart. The end of a thing is better than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. You know, I believe that a job well done, it's one of the best and most rewarding feelings in life. To get to an end of a project and be able to look back on it and say, wow, that's it. Hey, we did it. That's a great feeling, isn't it? The end of a thing is better than the beginning. This is also true of the works of God. The end of God's works is always better than the beginning. For in the beginning, God's work usually requires some difficult steps of faith on our part. The cross always precedes the crown. We're always called on to make some difficult steps and some acts of obedience. And it's so hard in the beginning because you don't know where it's going to end or where it's going to lead or how it's going to turn out. And yet you obey God anyway. It's tough, but you do it. And then in the beginning, in the end, you reap the reward. You know, the end of the thing has always been, at the end of the thing, you sit back, oh, praise the Lord, all right. It's great. Look how good God is. You weren't saying that in the beginning. Oh, woe is me. God, what are you doing? Oh, God, help me. You remember the wedding of Cana? The Lord saved the best wine to the last. He always does that. He saves the best bubbly to the last. Mourning may endure for a time, but joy comes in the morning. You know, so often, the Lord requires the long haul, and we take Satan's shortcuts. Gets us in trouble. Satan's works are just the opposite from God's works. God saves the best to last. The end of a thing is better than the beginning. But with Satan, it's always the opposite. The beginning of the thing is always better than the end. Satan serves you the best wine first. You taste the pleasure, the thrill. Oh, it's so great. But then you end up sucking sour grapes. The thing turns bitter and sours on you. Just the opposite. He says, do not hasten in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of fools. Do not say, why were the former days better than these? For you do not inquire wisely concerning this. In other words, stop longing for the good old days. It's been said that usually the good old days are a combination of a bad memory and a good imagination. If you really were to stop and think about it, the good old days weren't such good old days, were they? Yesterday is gone. Tomorrow may never come. Seize today. Make the most of it. It's the only day you have. I remember it was Martin Luther who said there were only 2 days on his calendar. Today and that day when Jesus Christ came back. Those are the only 2 days you really need to be concerned about. He says, wisdom is good with an inheritance and profitable to those who see the sun. For wisdom is a defense as money is a defense. But the excellence of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to those who have it. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what He has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. But in the day of adversity, consider. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other so that man can find nothing that will happen after him. Remember what Job told his wife? He said, shall we indeed accept good from God and shall we not accept adversity? Remember, adversity also comes from God. God is not only the author of good times, but He's also the author of tough times. It's been said that God gives us enough blessings to keep us happy and enough burdens to keep us humble. God wants us to live balanced lives. And so for all of the blessings He puts in our hands, He puts burdens on our back to keep us upright and to keep us balanced. God promised the children of Israel material comforts and the alleviation of physical discomforts. But God's promises to us are different. God hasn't promised us material comforts. God has promised us spiritual comforts. And He has not promised to take away all physical discomforts. He's promised to give us spiritual comforts in the midst of physical discomforts. It was Francis Bacon who described it. Prosperity is the blessing of the old covenant. Adversity is the blessing of the new covenant. God hasn't promised you a bed of roses. He said, blessed are those who are persecuted. He said, rejoice when men revile you and say all manner of evil against you falsely, for great is your reward in heaven. He hasn't promised us a bed of roses. Read the men of faith in Hebrews chapter 11. And all that they endured, all that they went through as a result of their faith. God uses tough times in our lives. We should be thankful for both, the good times and the bad times. Remember, it was Paul who said, I have learned how to be both abased and how to abound. How to have plenty and how to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. He says, I have seen all things in my days of vanity. There is a just man who perishes in his righteousness. And there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his wickedness. Do not be overly righteous, nor be overly wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Do not be overly wicked, nor be foolish. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you grasp this, and also not remove your hand from the other, for he who fears God will escape them all. Now, Solomon is not here promoting compromise and carnal living. He is simply telling us to live honest lives. In other words, don't try to make yourself out so righteous that you forget that you sin and that you do fall short of the glory of God. You know, there are some people who in their attempt to be so perfect, they forget that they're human. And they forget that, hey, John said, you know, he who says he has not sinned deceives himself and is a liar. And there are a lot of people who want to be perfect so bad, and when they're not, it leads to one of two things. They either get defeated and discouraged and give up, or else they ignore the sins that they do commit, sort of gloss over them, and become self-righteous and a hypocrite. What Solomon is saying is, hey, just be honest with yourself. You can never be totally righteous. You're going to sin, you're going to blow it sometimes. And yet on the other hand, he says, don't try to be overly wicked. Don't say, well, if I'm going to sin, there's no sense fighting against it. I might as well just accept it. I'll just go ahead and consent and concede to sin and go ahead and throw in the towel and live like the devil and trust in God's grace. A lot of people have taken that attitude. He's saying, no, you will sin sometimes. You will slip up, but don't concede the fight. Don't say, well, the Lord allows this to happen. No, it's your weakness. It's your sin, and you're responsible for it. Accept the fact that you sin. Repent of it and rise up with the power of the Holy Spirit and do something about it. So, just be honest with yourself at all times. You know, you'll never be as righteous as you want to be in the sight of heaven, and yet you're always going to need to improve. We all can always can walk in victory, and we can have an expanding victory over sin. He says, wisdom strengthens the wise more than 10 rulers of the city. For there is not a just man on earth who does good and does not sin. Also, do not take to heart everything people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. What good advice. You know, don't take to heart everything people say. You know, some of us, I mean, we get so bent out of shape. You just won't believe what that sister said about me. I'll never go back to that church. Don't take it to heart. You know, big deal. People are always going to talk. And they probably didn't mean it. It probably is a misunderstanding in the first place. But even if it's not, just don't take it to heart. Just keep loving them and eventually they'll be your friend. You know, you can't shut people's mouths, so you need to learn to shut your ears. You can't shut your ears. You can't shut people's mouths. And then listen to verse 22. You know, you need to not take it to heart, because there have been many times also your own heart has known that even you have cursed others. You've been just as guilty against other people as they've been to you. So get off of this self-righteous, oh, it happened to me. You know.
as if you've never done it to somebody else. All this I have proved by wisdom. I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. As for that which is far off and exceedingly deep, who can find it out? Now, wisdom serves a purpose. But again, like wealth, wisdom in and of itself is worthless. It's vain. It's chasing after bubbles. So what if you're wise? You're going to die. You're a dead wise guy. So what's the big deal? I mean, you're going to die just like the poor ignoramus. You know, so wisdom in and of itself is of no value. Anything in life has its value only as it relates to God and our life with God. He says, I applied my heart to know, to search and seek out wisdom and the reason of things, to know the wickedness of folly, even of foolishness and madness. And I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are fetters. He who pleases God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be taken by her. Now, perhaps Solomon is here uttering a confession, because remember, it was his desire for women and his multiplying of wives. And they brought in idolatry, and he became an idolater through the influence of his wives. And so this is what caused his spiral downwards in this quest to try to find meaning apart from God. And perhaps he's confessing that this is what's happened to him here in verse 26. He says, here is what I have found, says the preacher, or Ecclesiastes. Adding one thing to the other, putting things together, try to find out the reason. Which my soul still seeks, but I cannot find. One man among a thousand I have found, but a woman among all these I have not found. Again, the Living Bible has a helpful paraphrase. It says, this is my conclusion, says the preacher. Step by step, I came to this result after researching in every direction. 0.1% of the men I interviewed could be said to be wise, but not one woman. This is Solomon. This isn't me. Apparently, though, Solomon's experience with his wives had sort of soured his attitude toward women. This was not always the case, of course, as we'll find out in the Song of Solomon. I mean, that's a beautiful love story. I mean, what value, what beautiful treatment and all of the woman that he loved. Beautiful example of how to love a woman in the Song of Solomon. And we'll find that this was not always his attitude. Apparently, he, you know, through the course of time and through all these experiences that he had with these pagan women and the trouble that they brought him, that it did sour his attitude. Truly, this only I have found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. You know, he said he searched and he searched and he searched for meaning and purpose in life, and the only conclusion he's been able to draw is that things are not the way God intended for them to be. That something's gone haywire. And it's not God's fault. It's man who's made a mess of things. Solomon's conclusions under the sun. What a joy it is tonight, though, to know that God sent His Son, Jesus Christ, to clean up the mess. That He can straighten out your heart and your life. And He can give you a rich, fulfilling, satisfying life as you enter into a relationship with Him.